I actually got a sunburn while I was in Scotland, if you can believe that.
That's crazy. Yeah, Scotland. So I've got friends in Scotland, and that's probably the epitome of rain. It's crazy that you got a sunburn over there. But yeah, it's a great place.
Oh yeah, we had a great time, and whenever we were in London, it was sunny as well, and there was just everyone was out. We went to Victoria Park, you know that is.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an amazing little Sri Lankan restaurant in a gazebo in the middle of the park, which blew my mind, by the way.
Yeah.
It's like they didn't have to have such an awesome restaurant there. That could have been anything and it would still be popular, but they made this incredible like vegan Sri Lankan place. Anyway, just the park, just everyone was out on towels and just, you know, with their dogs. And he was like, it's not normally like this, you know, it's because the sun's out.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful thing about London and just generally in the UK. As soon as we get that, you know, that day or moment of sunshine, everyone's out. Everyone's trying to make the most of that moment. And actually, remember, you know, we were talking about our dogs earlier, and I sometimes think to myself, like, A, dogs are full of unconditional love, and it's almost like their life's purpose is to make you happy. But at the same time, dogs are so present. Like, you know, I mentioned earlier, my dog could be asleep, and I'll say, do you want to play with the ball? And he's up. He wants to make the most of that moment. And I feel like we can take so much inspiration from a dog's life because they truly see life as precious, not necessarily short because they've got no measure of time as such, but they know that every moment counts. And if we could live in the same way, life would be so wholesome and fulfilling. And, you know, I try to do that as often as I can. And as I was saying a few moments ago, before we started recording the podcast, I stepped away from social media for a bit. And when I say stepped away, I think it's very hard for you and I to completely step away from social media because we have to go there and post, engage with our audience. I truly believe in building a community rather than just trying to grow your followers, actually know your followers and know what they want. Because once you know your followers, you can almost be receptive to their energy. I think sometimes when I post, I feel like collectively my audience might be feeling a little down, a little gloomy, or they might need something to motivate them towards their goals. And I think I can only sense that because I've engaged with my audience. But on the other side, you can end up spending so many hours on social media, and you and I and our, you know, our whole team, our whole crew, the other authors that, you know, we share a space with, we talk a lot about being mindful, about being present, about being in the moment. And the best way for us to convey those teachings is to practice those teachings. And sometimes I find the conflict within my own work where I'm telling people to be present, yet I've spent 7 hours on my phone. I've spent hours trying to please algorithms, and I almost become enslaved to those algorithms because I want to, you know, I want to reach people. And I suppose that's the ego in me trying to, you know, take some sense of control and pride in what I do. And I think that's okay. But at the same time, I think when it truly detaches you from your life's purpose, it can be quite counterproductive and counterintuitive. And that's why I took some time out just to really recenter myself. After I released my latest book, Closer to Love, I was inundated with requests. Can you go on, you know, TV to do this interview? Can you do a talk here? Can you do a talk there? Can you do a podcast interview? Are you interested in launching a course? And all these things I'm extremely grateful for because it means that people are willing to listen to me and hear me out, and people value and treasure my teachings. But at the same time, I think, especially as a content creator, as someone that wants to share wisdom with the world, we can get so lost in it all, trying to, you know, please people, I suppose, trying to sell more books, trying to increase the numbers. And we forget why we started doing what we did. And those foundational teachings, the things that led us to the wisdom that we then go on to share with the world. There's a spiritual teacher who's no longer around, one of my teachers, one of the biggest researchers in consciousness, Dr. David R. Hawkins. And he talks about, or he did speak about, spiritual teachers. And he said a lot of those teachers started with a certain level of consciousness. And their desire to help people was very authentic. And a lot of the time it was created by some kind of pain or some kind of, you know, dark night of the soul that they experienced. And then as they grew an audience and more people desired their energy and they started to make money, everything almost become very ego-led. And as consciousness can expand, it can also kind of contract. It can also collaborate to lower levels, I believe. And he did a measure of where people started and where people ended. And he found that a lot of spiritual teachers actually lost their way. And it's not that they're bad people, or they're greedy people necessarily. It's just that the practices that led you to who you are and why people follow you can then suddenly become secondary when your primary purpose suddenly is to grow more followers, to be more famous, to be more rich. And I think it's extremely difficult to navigate that path with a bit of balance where it's, I'm going to share my energy with the world, but I'm also going to conserve that energy and return home to myself, to my heart, to my spiritual practices, so I can continue my evolutionary journey. And I think I realized that at that moment, I thought to myself, well, actually, I need to take it a step back because I'm kind of losing myself in this whole process. And instead of making decisions led by a sense of wholeness or my intuition, I'm making decisions based on, you know, what's right for my business as such, or what's going to please the people that have, you know, like, for example, publishers that have, you know, invested money in me. And that, I think, can be a very, very difficult path to navigate. And that's why I've just taken a step back and, you know, I've returned and I'm spending more time on social media than I was, but it's still a very minimal. I'm kind of like here posting, interacting with people and then stepping back, continuing to spend more time meditating because I meditate every morning. And although I don't want to say I meditate for half an hour or 2 hours, because if I be completely honest, I meditate for as long as I feel like I need to meditate on that particular day. But it can range between, you know, 20 minutes and 2 hours. I don't think I ever really exceed 2 hours because, you know, I do have other things to attend to. But, you know, it's taking a step back gives me a chance to return to that without the panic of, oh, I've got an interview at this time. I need to do this. I need to write that. I need to complete that chapter. And the whole reason for meditation is to tame that inner chatter, to live in that space between the thoughts, that silence. And, you know, being able to return to that and being able to live from that space has, you know, almost given me this sense of clarity again. And I feel like I've found that balance again. And, you know, I'm not saying where I'm at full of bliss and perfection, but it's so much more healthy, I think, for me than what I was doing around the launch of my book. So I think that step back really, really helped me just find that sense of balance again.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And there's a lot in there, you know, and I think that what you said, I think that first off, like about feeling a bit of conflict when posting things about presence or whatever, but not really being present in your life, I think that's really natural. You know, I think it's like, I experience the same thing sometimes. Whenever I'm stressed or I'm irritated and I'm posting something about like, you know, mindful connection or something like that, whenever I was just not mindful in my own connection, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, at some level, all of us, like what we write about is in a deeply subconscious way what we need at that time. Mm-hmm. So if we're writing about it's like another way of understanding yourself. You know, you're sort of like externally self-actualizing so that you can get that feeling or those subconscious fragments like out into the open so that you can observe them from the outside and then integrate them in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of times I find that like what I'm writing that a few days later or a week later, I'll be like, oh yeah, that was like what I was going through. I didn't even really realize it at the time, you know? So yeah. I think there's certainly something about that. And it's kind of like the saying goes is like most life coaches' personal lives are like terrible, you know? That's just kind of a classic thing. And it's because they, you know, they're doing the work that they need. They're good at helping other people, but it may be that they're not as good at applying that to themselves. But I find it really interesting. And I really relate to what you were talking about as far as like, as you grow and scale, like in a professional way that, you know, does the game changes? Does your writing change? Do your intentions mm-hmm. change? Does your ability to really live what you're writing shift? And I think that in my own experience, what I've observed is that, you know, in the beginning, it's like a brain state where all you're thinking about are the practices and the work and, you know, kind of the arising wisdom, because you have all this open, like mental real estate. You're not dealing with interviews. You're not dealing with people pitching you things. You're not dealing with like maintaining an audience. You're not dealing with, I know it sounds funny, but like the stress that comes with finance, like you're talking about, you know, you, mm-hmm. whenever you start making money, you have more obligations and you have more pressure and you have more, you know, like you said, you're a publisher, you're like, oh, well, they're counting on me to deliver. And I got like, now people are watching and they've written checks and I have to deliver now. Like that's the type of pressure that didn't exist in the beginning. So your whole, like the neuroplasticity of your brain, the whole direction of your consciousness is fully rooted in nothing but the work and the teachings. Mm-hmm. And so slowly, as you begin to grow and you get more, you know, bigger audience, you get more opportunities. I really think that there's just this long, like protracted brain reshaping that has to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that that may go on forever. You know, I think it really might, because I've been doing it for years and I feel like I'm still doing it. It's because like, as you expand and you kind of reach new levels and you're dealing with new territory, that original space where you were just open to always think on the work kind of gets cut in half. Because mm-hmm. now you're like, oh, I didn't even have all these switches in my brain before. I don't know like what to, like, I'm not used to having to balance this stuff. And so you sort of have to learn it, I think, along the way and learn how to balance like what it means to be doing this stuff at scale in public mm-hmm. and what it means to be still trying to stay closely attached and rooted in the original source through which all of it came. And it's a real balance, man. It's a balancing act. And I feel like I've gone back and forth many times where I found myself being like, just, I jokingly call it reptile brain, where you're just in pure business mode, where it's like, you know, you're thinking about nothing about like the business side of things. And I'm like, oh, I'm in like reptile brain. I got to get out of that and get back to, you know, more heart-centered and more, you know, return to the space I know I need to be in. And, you know, I think that just doing something like you did is all you can do, is when you become conscious of the fact that you're getting pulled away from balance, to just do those things, you know, that will rebalance you. This podcast is brought to you by HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get farm fresh pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. A busy fall schedule doesn't always leave you with time to spare, and with HelloFresh, you don't need to spend all evening in the kitchen to whip up a wholesome meal. With their quick and easy recipes and 15-minute meals, you can get a tasty dinner on the table in less time than it takes to get takeout or delivery. And when it comes to options, honestly, more is more. That's why HelloFresh's menu includes 40 recipes and over 100 add-on items to choose from every week. I have had some HelloFresh meals, and each of them were very tasty. They were easy to make. The recipes were really intuitive, and it was fun to try something that I have not had before or wouldn't have thought to make for myself. So get fresh meals delivered to your door today. Go to HelloFresh.com/50hitme and use the code 50HITME for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. Once again, that's HelloFresh.com/50HITME and use the code 50HITME for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months.
I think that's the key, is to finding that balance. I don't know if you know much about my journey, Corey, but when I was younger, so my dad passed away when I was 6 months old, and then my family and I were technically homeless for 3 years. And I say technically homeless because we weren't out on the streets, but you know, we didn't have a home that was guaranteed to accommodate us. So we stayed at hotels, hostels with family members and so forth. And some of those hostels especially were, you know, horrifying. So much blood and violence that took place, so many creepy characters. And yeah, poverty was this kind of ongoing theme. So when we finally got a council estate that we could call ours, a home that we could call ours, it didn't quite pan out as the dream we thought it was unfolding as. Soon as I would step outside of that house, I'd face tons of racism, people telling me to, you know, go back to my own country, kids wanting to fight me. And eventually I did fight back. It wasn't that I wanted to fight people, and it wasn't even that I wanted to hurt people. It was just me trying to defend myself. And I always feel like anger as well is your defense against pain. But poverty, you know, my mom's a single mother. She has three kids, isn't really in work, trying to put food on the table. And there's all these problems created because money was so scarce. And I remember thinking to myself that I need to change my life, because this life can't continue. Every single day I'm waking up thinking, oh my God, like another day in hell, another day of suffering, another day where, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm only assuming the worst will happen. And the reason I'm assuming the worst will happen, which I didn't realize at the time, was because, you know, I'd gone through experiences where I'd seen like a gun to my uncle's head, my mum, my sisters, who were only 2 years older than me, sorry. So at the time I was 5 or 6 years old, I saw my uncle's shop getting robbed, and you know, he had a bloodied nose, a gun to his head. My mom was getting beaten, my aunt was getting beaten, and my sisters, who would have been around 7 and 9 at the time, were also getting hurt. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always felt unsettled because of that experience. And every time I walked out into the world, I felt like there was, you know, threats there, even if they weren't present. But the problem was when we got our first council home, the threats continued. I was living in an area that was not only highly racist, but we had kidnappers around. So my school was literally, I think, around a 5-minute walk from my house, but just walking from my school to my home is dangerous because we had these, you know, these characters that would try and kidnap you. Life was hell, and I felt like the only solution to escape that life, to get rid of all of our problems, was to make more money. So I almost obsessed myself over money. I said to myself, when I'm older, I'm going to become this multimillionaire, and it will solve all of my family's problems and my problems. And that was really the panacea, the solution to all this suffering that we were experiencing. And it's funny because when people say, you know, there's always like celebrities and public figures or people that have kind of made it as such, and I know that's quite subjective, but people that have made it, and they say, oh, it's so easy for you to say that money doesn't bring you happiness. You know, I feel like I'm at this place now where I've got my security, my basic needs are met. You know, I'm very grateful that I was able to clear all of my mum's debt that she'd accumulated for, you know, 30 years of my life, I've able to liberate her completely financially. While I can always desire more, I feel like I'm in a safe and secure place financially. But what happens, just like you said, is there's always new challenges that arise. And if I said to someone now that my biggest challenge is just staying true to who I am and having integrity in what I do, they'd be like, well, you know, that's nothing. You know, right. You compare it to the past, it's nothing. And I do sometimes have to tune into that and make that comparison and think to myself, actually, yeah, things can be difficult, you know, making those decisions that, those difficult decisions where you're trying to stay true to yourself, but also trying to expand in the work that you do. Yes, that's difficult. But before, what was difficult was trying to put food on the table or to just survive to make it through the day. So comparatively, you know, what I'm experiencing now is very minuscule, but at the same time, that's not to say that the challenges that I feel don't exist. And I think I've just been able to handle, I suppose not even handle, I've been able to acknowledge everything that I feel and my emotions. And like you said, like even when we write from, and oftentimes, I don't know if you would agree with this, Corey, but when you share a message, it's this insight maybe that comes, you know, from a moment. But a lot of the time you are writing for yourself. It's almost advice that you're giving to some aspect of you, whether it's the wounded ego, it's the past version of you, or it's just something that you need reaffirming. And it just feels so real. And that's why you want to share it with the world, because you know, if you need it and you can benefit from that message, so can other people. And that's, you know, you said that a few moments ago, and I think that's so true. And now I'm at this place where it's just a place of ease. It's more of an acceptance that, you know, there's some things I can control and there's some things that I can't. And also, change is the only constant. So let's move through the motions. If I can change something within that moment, great. If I can't, that's okay too. Let's just go through the motions and see what pops up. And I think, you know, taking that time out really gave me that sense of clarity. And now, and I'm not saying I can practice this to perfection, but now I'm trying to just have fun.
Yeah, yes.
In this playground that we call life, it's, you know, not saying that challenges and problems aren't real. You know, it wasn't yesterday, it was the day before yesterday. A girl messaged me and it's actually very sad. And, you know, I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I released my first book, Good Vibes, Good Life, in 2018. And the book, you know, I had an audience of like 140,000 followers at the time. I signed with my dream publisher, Hay House. Everything seemed to be going amazing. I released the book and I was kind of a little bit underwhelmed. And I was underwhelmed because in my head, I felt like I will release a book and it's going to become this massive bestseller right away. And it didn't do any of that. But what it did do, it did touch people. And in 2019, a few months after the book was released, because the book was released in December, this girl messaged me called Marie. Actually, she didn't message me. She tagged me in a post. And the picture she posted was of her with lots of scars all over her body. And that's because, unfortunately, she used to self-harm. And she had posted a picture of my book to her community. And she said, this book saved my life. You know, I wouldn't have lived a particular night where she was in hospital if it wasn't for this book. And that really touched me. And, you know, it just kind of reaffirmed that I'd chosen this path for a reason. And although I might not make bestseller lists, I can change one person's life, and that's enough, because that's one person that's better off in the world. But the other day, her friend messaged me and she said, you know, unfortunately, Marie is no longer around. sadly she passed. And, you know, that just really, it hit me so deeply. It was like, wow, like, you know, that I went back to that message and I remembered how much she'd done for me as an author, how much inspiration she gave me, how much motivation she gave me to carry on, and just how much reassurance I had from her message that I was, you know, that I was doing what I feel like I was called to do. And in that moment, it just, you know, I had a mixture of emotions, but, you know, I felt this heaviness and this sadness. And then her friend messaged me again, and it was the most kindest thing I think I've someone's ever said to me. She said, "Thank you for gifting Marie of, you know, 4 extra years, because if it wasn't for your book," and it was, you know, I was going through this roller coaster of emotions there. It was one moment it was deep sadness, the next minute it was gratitude, then there was this, you know, innate feeling of love, and, you know, it was just, but what I'm trying to say, Corey, is that problems, although a lot of people would say subjectively, you know, problems can, a problem's maybe not a problem if you don't think it's a problem, problems will always exist and pain will always be there. But what I think I've grown to do over time is realize that pain's just the feeling, and suffering's just the response. And although I can acknowledge those emotions, I don't necessarily have to carry them forward. That's not to say that I won't grieve, that I might not mourn if I've lost something, but it's just to, you know, unload the tension that, that those emotions, those dark and heavy emotions might bring. And yeah, over the last few months, I've had so much clarity now that I just feel like I'm in a good space. And you will know this so well, that when you return to this sense of wholeness, you're able to give so much more to the people around you. And I truly believe that our audiences, although it's through a digital medium, they sense and feel their energy. And if something isn't quite right with you, I feel like people will feel that energetically. There's this transfer that takes place. But when things are right with you, although not everyone might be receptive to it, I feel that a lot of people can feel it. And it's just sometimes this comforting hug. Like this week especially, I've had so many, you know, thoughtful and kind messages in my inbox saying, you know, this spoke to me and thank you so much for existing. And it's just, it's just been nice to hear. And I know that sounds quite, you know, maybe a little bit superficial, but I think even as creators, we sometimes need that, just to know that, you know, we're aligned and we're, you know, we're touching and reaching people in the right way.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just weird to be like sending out messages and it reaching millions of people every week, and you're like in a vacuum, you know. Yeah. It's like, you're not meeting any of these people per se. And so to have them message you, I mean, I get, I don't know, like dozens of DMs a day, if not more than that, of people just saying what you said. And it's nice. And I try, and I actually at least, like, you know, heart them all or say thank you, because it's like, I really do appreciate the fact that someone took the time to just say, hey, this is helpful for me, you know?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, not to be a self-quoter here, but one of the things you were talking about earlier, really reminded me of this. Something I shared one time was that peace is accepting that everything changes. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's something that it took me, you know, years to kind of work with and understand. And ultimately, what I'm talking about is not only understanding impermanence, but accepting impermanence. Mm-hmm. And like living in a way where it's not just the concept. You know, that's one of the big things I find that happens in this type of stuff, is that you get the idea and you carry the idea around. You're like, great, I know this, but like, why isn't it helping me? It's like, well, because it hasn't been embodied yet. You know, you're not living the idea. You're just, it's in the mind. And to me, it was a long process of learning how to live and, you know, respect and an acceptance of impermanence. And then whenever I started doing that, I began to be able to like see what I like to call the upside of impermanence, you know, because I think, you know, most of my audience is very familiar with the idea of impermanence, but quickly, you know, it's a concept in Buddhism that essentially everything will decay and go away and turn into nothingness over whatever the timeline is for that thing. And that can sound like a real bummer on the face. They're like, oh, great. So everyone I know, everything I like in the universe is all going to turn to nothingness. Yeah. What a beautiful concept. Yeah. But really it's about, you know, the point of it is about internal change. It's about, you know, you are a point of awareness and things arise, thoughts, emotions, and feelings arise. And they are temporary, you know, they pass through just like suffering and, you know, desire and yearning, understanding and conflict, you know, and self, you know, negative self-talk and all those things. And being able to observe those things from a place where you see them as, you know, mental formations moving through you as opposed to a fundamental part of your identity is a huge breakthrough. Because you start to see like, oh, I'm not that suffering. That is like just a, you know, it's a cloud that's moving through me at this moment in time. And I think the more that you can accept that that's, you know, how things are, the more that you can liberate yourself from being, you know, drawn into those feelings, because that's where attachment comes from, of course, is that we experience something like that that is arresting to us and it feels almost alluring, like we can't not. It's like a, if you have a hurt tooth, it's hard not for your tongue to go there and just touch it. Like it just happens. And this is, it's the same type of mechanism. And it's because those emotions are less common and they're more intense. Therefore, we're less prepared to deal with them. And then we think that we have to tend to them in order to get them to solve them like a puzzle. So we get into them, then we get attached to them, and then that we manifest them to becoming more and more real because, of course, our thoughts then influence how we feel, that influence how we act in the world. And so we truly start living as if those things are a part of us, and then we start seeing proof of it because that's how we're moving through the world, you know? And so if we start to recognize that they're just these passing and permanent things, it really cuts down the chance that we'll become attached to them and have and prolong them longer than they need to be in our lives.
I think, you know what I love that you touched on just before the impermanence was embodying the teachings. That for me has been a real game changer. When I was on this, and I don't even like to put labels to things like this, you know, I call it spiritual and people will say, well, what is spiritual? Hugging trees? Is it, you know, consciousness? What is spiritual? But, you know, being on this path, I remember I read a lot of ancient spiritual literature and I intellectualized a lot of those ideas and concepts. And I think, you know, when you've only intellectualize those things when you fail to practice those things. And one of my teachers is a teacher in Advaita Vedanta, which is non-duality, and he said to me, reject all the teachings. And I said, why would I reject the teachings? You're teaching me things, why would I reject the teachings? He said, because for wisdom to truly be yours, it has to come from you. It has to come from your experiences. So why don't you go out into the world and prove the teachings wrong to then realize that they're right? And only then that can be your wisdom. And when it's your wisdom, you will see a change in your state, in your consciousness. But a lot of the time what we have, and I think I did this a lot in my early days, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it, because I think sometimes we need those reminders for ourselves, and other people can also benefit from those reminders. But it's almost like we describe the taste of wine based on what we've read about wine, but not based on the taste of wine. And there's only so much we can reach people. There's only so much we can say based on the intellectualization of what we've learned about the wine. There's not the true wisdom, the true experience of, you know, consuming that wine. And that's what I've hopefully been able to do, or at least try and stay committed to, is it's just going out there in the world and trying to embody these teachings and finding my own kind of path. And that for me has been a game changer. And what it's taught me about impermanence is that, like you said, we, you know, everything in life is kind of transient. The only thing that isn't is the awareness that's there. Everything else, our body, you know, the emotions, all of these things are constantly in a state of flux. They're constantly going to move. And if someone's attached to how they look in a few years' time, they might, you know, experience severe suffering because they're clinging on to how they once looked. But I actually find so much beauty in impermanence, because what change says to us is, if we're suffering in the moment, that there's a moment that might come along where that suffering isn't present. But also it teaches us to really treasure those good moments, treasure what we have in this moment. If something's going good, I think you become more grateful for it. If something's not going quite to plan, something undesirable is being experienced, then what impermanence tells us is that there's a following moment that's coming where things can be much more lighter for you. And that's why I think impermanence can be so beautiful, depending on the way you interpret impermanence in your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it, something that came to me one time was when thinking a lot about impermanence was that there's actually, there's what I call the upside of impermanence. So mm-hmm. we usually think it of it as just things fading away. But for things to be constantly fading away, there must always be things coming into existence. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of like stuck in between the coming and going of all things. Yeah. And that tracks with what you were just saying, as far as if you're in a challenging moment, knowing that in the pipeline, you know, there are much more of the abundant, beautiful moments that are coming. This just happens to be what's, you know, playing on the movie screen right now.
Yeah. I think I posted a quote. I can't remember exactly what I posted, but it's something about saying goodbye. And I think you commented with something like, with every goodbye, there's also a new hello as well. And that really encapsulates what you just said.
Yeah. So I don't want to miss the question I ask people on the podcast now, because of the we've just been in a nice conversation here, but we'll go ahead and tick the box of the premise of the show. And that is essentially looking at what an insight you had in your life or in your career. And there are no rules of how you can answer this, but something that changed how you thought fundamentally about yourself and the work that you were doing that enabled you to go from living a normal life to then being able to start living the life that was, you know, that you had imagined was possible for you.
So it's a really good question. So in my teenage years, I looked around and I saw everyone around me experiencing the same struggle. So I grew up in a state that I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to put a label to it. It's far from the ghetto as such, but you know, it's not an estate that has people that are financially secure. Let's just put it that way. You know, there's a lot happening. And I remember turning to some of my friends and saying, look, you know, what we're experiencing here isn't right. Like, there's more for us outside of this. And they couldn't quite understand that. All they had known was pain and suffering. So for them, it was like, no, this is the life for you. And I remember speaking to one of my, it wasn't even a relative. I think my mum had taken me to the temple, and because, you know, I'm Hindu born, and I remember speaking to an elder and just saying, you know, like, I'm not happy with my life. Like, why has God made me suffer? And the answer, I think the response I got was that, you know, some people are just made to suffer. Like, you just got to accept your life. And I didn't quite like that answer. I didn't quite like any of the answers that I was hearing. And I didn't have any mentors. I didn't have anyone to turn to. And in fact, a lot of the time I found solace through hip hop. So I used to listen to a lot of hip hop, listen to a lot of like Tupac Shakur, Nas, AZ, Cormega, you know, the kind of like the gritty hip hop that I grew up on, at least anyway. And, you know, I used to see myself in a lot of the lyrics, but I used to also find a lot of wisdom. And as the internet, and I'm not going to say the internet emerged at this time, but I was quite young and I remember having a 56K dial-up modem. And I was one of the only few in my school that would be going on the internet every other day. And there was this hip hop forum that I used to go to all the time to check the new releases. And within that hip hop forum, there was a sub forum and they used to talk about life, philosophy, spirituality, you know, neuroscience and all those kind of things. And I was drawn to those deeper concepts and, you know, the ancient Mayans, for example, all that kind of stuff. And I remember everyone talking about this one book that had changed so many lives. And someone said this book had also changed Bruce Lee's life. And I was a massive martial arts fan. And I was like, well, if it's changed Bruce Lee's life, maybe it can change my life. So I obtained a copy of this book. Of course, at the time I had no money. So, you know, don't do this, but I did it through LimeWire. if it makes anyone feel better, I actually downloaded the book along with a lot of viruses as well. But so I started reading this book and it's Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And that started altering my mindset. And what I realized within that moment is that, and you know, Wayne Dyer says this, if you change the way you look at things, the things that you look at change. Joseph Murphy in The Power of the Subconscious Mind said, you know, you can't change the wind, but you can adjust your sails. And what I realized by reading that book and the other following books that followed was that, you know, I don't have to be a victim to my circumstances. The circumstances are present. And, you know, in the future, I found I started to look at it in a different way, to see it as a path to this kind of evolutionary journey, because I feel like pain can teach you in ways that pleasure cannot, simply. But in that particular moment, this 14 or 15-year-old kid realized that if I continue to see myself as a victim, life was always going to treat me like a victim. And if I started to see myself as a victor, maybe I can achieve more kind of victories within my life. I didn't have to take the circumstances as a reflection of who I am and what I will experience in the future. I've got a choice to make. Everyone's got a choice to make. And I know that choice can be hard depending on the cards that you're dealt with. But I can start looking at things differently. I can start seeking out opportunities. And it's within that moment, within that period where I read that book, that I started to change my life for the better. And that's why a lot of my work, especially my earlier work, was mainly around positive thinking, not in the sense that you deny the reality in front of you, but just that you invite hope and optimism. And I think if I didn't adopt that positive mentality from that particular point, then I wouldn't be living the life that I'm living right now. So for me, that was the game-changing point. And in fact, what I did was I became so obsessed with mindset, and I was so into sports and obviously music and even entrepreneurship at the time. And like I said earlier, I was so obsessed with making money that I would wait until the Rich List would be published, and be published in a newspaper here in the UK. And I would study all the individuals within the top 10 of the Rich List. And I would look at their background, how they grew up, the type of mindsets they had. And I remember reading the Rich List one time, and three of the people within the top 10 of that Rich List were orphans. And I thought, wow, these guys came from extreme hardship, and now they've created something so successful. Then I look at, you know, Michael Jordan, I look at Albert Einstein, I look at all these heroic, iconic figures, and I thought to myself, what separates them from the rest of, you know, the public? And everything came down to mindset. And that's when I realized, you know, I felt empowered by these stories. And I said to myself, well, if they can do it, you know, why can't I do it? And that was the moment where I think everything shifted for me. And, you know, I'm not saying life then just flipped, you know, 10 days later. It wasn't like I manifested this great life, because I went through so much tumultuous experiences, but things started shifting. And I feel like those small shifts compound eventually into something, you know, much greater. And that's where I am now as a result of those small shifts created from that one moment.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And so true too. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. if everything you experience is in your mind, then your mind dictates everything you experience, mm-hmm. you know, and understanding that and being, and that's the difficult part, I think, is being able to believe that that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of people go like, oh, well, okay, I'd love to change my mindset and start, you know, doing, you know, what I can imagine is possible. But
yeah,
I'm just stuck in this, like, this is what life is. Like, I can't do it. And it's like, that's the problem. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just that easy, but it's so, well, it's simple, but it's so difficult, I think, to flip that switch. And, you know, we usually need an external catalyst, you know, like you're reading that book or something, you know, to experience something like that. But I think one of the interesting elements of that is that how would changing to a belief, like a mindset of confidence and belief in whatever it is that, you know, because we're always all visualizing a better ideation of the future. I think that what separates someone who reaches that and someone who doesn't is someone who actually starts living in that way that they're visualizing, as opposed to someone that goes like, oh, that would be nice, but I'm daydreaming, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not possible, you know. But what's interesting, and I think that maybe like a breadcrumb that someone listening to this could follow, is that whenever you start really, you know, believing and embodying that mindset of confidence and self-belief, to start watching in like nuanced ways how you feel and how people around you start responding to you differently. Mm-hmm. Because whenever you get into that mindset, you start like glowing in a different way. Like self-belief and self-trust comes with a strange type of energy where you feel more radiant, you know?
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that other people, they may not be like intellectualizing it, but they sense it and they can feel it and they respond to it. And in a strange way, that's one of the like attractors that makes doors open. It makes people want to be, because if you've got that energy, people want to be close to you. They want to be in business with you. They want to be around you because they're like, this person is shining and like that, mm-hmm. that's something special, you know? So it's interesting how not only does that mindset shift of confidence start making it to where you get off your ass and start taking steps towards really building something, but it also creates this interesting fundamental internal change, which then sort of collaborates with the actions that you're taking.
Mm-hmm. I think you've just summed it up so perfectly. There's definitely this glow up that happens when you start really living in line with the things that you believe. And something I said a few moments ago, which, because people always tell me, you know, how do you change your beliefs? And the thing is, this conditioning that we have that's created certain beliefs, especially limiting beliefs, has occurred over a lifetime. So for you to then change your mindset overnight is extremely difficult, because you've believed the things you believe for most of your life. So you can't expect to undo that conditioning, that heavy wiring, within one moment or within one night. But what I did, and I was unconsciously doing this, is when I mentioned earlier that I was studying other iconic individuals and I was looking for proof in their own life, it was kind of creating, and I think it was taking advantage of this confirmation bias that we all have, is that when you start to believe something, you know, you really look out for things that support those beliefs. And that's what I started doing, is I saw the beliefs, you know, I saw the things that other people were doing in their own life. And I saw how people that, you know, didn't have the most kind of majestic upbringings were still creating success in their lives. I saw that they were able to do it. That gave me some self-belief. And then that would inspire me to look for moments within my own life where I had done things that I thought maybe I wasn't able to do. And the more you do that, the more you start creating these new neural pathways, and suddenly it becomes natural. So that positivity and that optimism becomes not only natural, but it becomes very genuine. I always say to people, you know, positivity will change your life, but it has to be genuine positivity, which means no spiritual bypassing. And that, you know, it's difficult because sometimes people, you know, they want change very quickly. They want to believe that they can manifest a greater life for themselves, you know, straight away. And the reality is that that doesn't always happen because we've adopted things, you know, over generations. And if you believe in reincarnation, there's, you know, samsaras that we've, you know, picked up from our previous lifetimes. That's if you believe or adopt to that perspective. But, you know, it's a process. It's a slow process. And when it does become authentic, there is this gravitational pull. People start looking at you and they might compliment you. They might say, oh, wow, you know, there's this glow that's emanating from you, or this. Have you changed, you know, have you changed something about yourself? Have your eyes gone lighter, or, you know, does your beard look bright? I don't know. But there is this natural glow, I think, that occurs, and that pulls more people in towards you that are A, looking for you for, you know, looking at you for maybe, you know, or looking at you as almost like this sanctuary for healing. So you will attract people that want to almost not feed off your energy, but see or perceive your sense of wholeness and want to return to the wholeness within themselves. So there's those people that are attracted to you, but there's also people that are very aligned to you. And especially in business, you'll find that there's people that not only want to work with you, but are coming from a similar place. Mm-hmm. It's almost like your awareness or your new level of awareness is pulling in people working from that same level of awareness. And together you can create something so fruitful and so beautiful. And that's certainly something that I've experienced in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll shout out to the crew primary.
Yeah.
I mean, in that impatience, as far as like wanting to change overnight, is it's like any of those conflicts, I've always looked to nature. It's like, well, nature is like always has it right. And everything that we need to learn, we can learn if we look metaphorically or even literally at nature enough. And this is one of those things of like, if you want a tomato, you can't just go like, all right, there's the soil, here's a seed, boom, give it to me tomorrow. It's like, there's a process. It takes time. It takes nurturing. It takes effort. But there are also clear steps to how to grow something like that. And it's the same type of thing. It's like just recognizing that, okay, you are succeeding by taking action. You know, planting the seed is success. Watering the garden is success. Tending the garden is success. Keeping the squirrels away, which we'll say are bad thoughts, negative thoughts, is success. Yeah. You know? And it's just recognizing it's this process is really useful. And before we wrap up, I just want to ask, so you mentioned your first book wasn't a bestseller immediately, but then it went on to sell over a million copies, right? How did that happen?
It's so funny because I get asked this question a lot. And I remember speaking to Diego Young Pueblo, another brilliant writer who's part of our crew.
The crew primary, and, you know,
And he asked me, like, you know, what did I do? And I didn't change anything. I really believed in the work that I was putting out there. When I wrote the book, I prayed after every line that I wrote. I didn't change anything about my platforms. I shared messages like I always do, and I always have since 2015. I just put the same energy out there, and I had the intention out there. I didn't even get, you know, mainstream media support. There was no TV shows, no major radio stations. There was like potentially one, but there was nothing you know, there wasn't even influencers that were, that I'd paid or that I'd, you know, sent the book out to that were really changing the trajectory of the book. What happened was people just naturally found it. It was, I think my initial audience, so my, you know, my immediate audience that bought the book, they really resonated with it and they became my cheerleaders. And as they became my cheerleaders, I think they inspired their own audiences to go out and pick up the book. And then those people, and I'm not saying all of them did, but a lot of those people really resonated with the book. And it was almost like this domino effect. And suddenly I had celebrities that I hadn't even heard of sharing my book. And I was just like, wow, like who are these people? And I'd Google people and be like, oh my days, like I've never even heard of that person, but this person's like a TV star. And you know, from there, you know, the energy and the momentum was there. And you know, eventually I did become a number one Sunday Times, which we have in the UK, bestseller. And you know, that was a really precious moment for me. And then, you know, we ended up doing 2 years on the Sunday Times, which was
amazing.
Again, you know, more than I could have asked for. But I, you know, I don't do my work for the accolades and the titles. Like that stuff's, don't get me wrong, that stuff's great. And from a, you know, a perception point of view, those things help. People take you more seriously when you've got a certain title. I completely get that. But I don't want that to change what I put out there. And I don't want any book to be out in the world if it's not coming from my heart. And that's what I try to do. I try to write from the heart. I don't try to work to deadlines, although publishers do have deadlines. You know, I don't want to sacrifice the creativity, the energy, the belief, the ideas, the concepts, everything that I put into the book. You know, I don't want to sacrifice any of those things to become a bestseller, to become this big author, to meet a deadline. Like that's my non-negotiable, is that if I see a purpose for a book, I need to put all of myself into that book. I need to put all of my energy. And there's this, you know, really famous quote. I can't remember who said it, but it basically says what comes from the heart goes to the heart. And for me, that's my number one marketing, I suppose, you know, my number one marketing insight is just do things from the heart. And if you do things from the heart, you know, they'll reach other people's hearts. And you can't trade that. You know, you can always be smarter with the way you market stuff. And I you know, within our crew, we share, you know, great insights that we've learned from our journeys being online on social media or, you know, doing mainstream things. But I think when you do something that comes from a deeper place within you, it will reach deeply within other people, and that will help you almost find the success that you may or may not be looking for. And that's how it happens. So honestly, there's no magic formula. I mean, I was, you know, I was resharing people that were sharing my book to Instagram stories, but you know, there's no other magic formula. I will say though, you know, my next book, it was an instant number one bestseller. The book after that, you know, because I established myself as an author, it went to number two in the Sunday Times chart, but it didn't get the number one spot. Prince Harry.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that wasn't really fair. That one wasn't fair. You were number one. Yeah, truly.
But saying that, you know, like I've not seen that instrumental success I saw of the first book, but you know, does that make me feel like a failure? Am I a failure because of that? I'm putting out the work that I want to put out to help people, and you know, I want to serve people. So that's where I'm working from right now. And although it would be absolutely amazing to sell more books, to reach more people, to, you know, to make a difference in the world, like the way I share my work is trying not to put that as the priority. All of that I feel like can come as a result of just putting pure and authentic energy out there.
Yeah.
And I know that's not always the answer people want to hear when it comes to marketing or selling your book. But I truly believe that is to just do things from the heart.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why you've had the success you have, because all that stuff about trying to like position something to be a bestseller and using like tactics and all that stuff, that no one really knows what works in that regard. Like mm-hmm. if like in publishers or marketing people will tell you like, this is what we have to do because this is what works. It's like, if you knew what works, every book you publish would be number one bestseller, and mm-hmm. it's not. So you don't know what works. You have guesses based on experience, which we'll take into account, but no one knows what works. The mm-hmm. only thing that works or has the chance of working is exactly what you were talking about, is forgetting about the rules, forgetting about what you're supposed to do, and just focusing on writing something that means something to you, like mm-hmm. bringing what you want to see into the world to life, and being honest about it and writing from the heart and creating from the heart. Like, that's all that matters, because that's what gets you, what creates that type of, you know, seismic success, which is people feel it. And then they talk, because the really the best marketing is word of mouth. And if you mm-hmm. had, you know, 140,000 followers at the time, and you get, you know, obviously it doesn't work like this, but if each of them then went and told 10 friends, boom, you sold a million copies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's only, people are only going to talk about it like that if it hits them on this deep human level where it really is like, it changes their life and is impactful. Mm-hmm. And you can only get that if that's where you write from, you know? Yeah. So that's really the key. And it's not what people want to hear, because you know what I mean? Because it just, yeah. I don't know, because it takes effort to, you know, open that space and write from there. It's a long process of learning how to even find that place within yourself and how to externalize mm. it, you know, but once you do, you know, then it's pretty magical.
I think as well, people sometimes, you know, they look at celebrities, you know, who have massive followings, and some of them have cult-like followings, and, you know, they're going to sell a ridiculous amount of books within their first week. They're going to make all these bestseller lists. They're going to get placements on every top TV morning show. And, you know, that's going to do the numbers. But is that the most important thing? You know, yeah. A lot of the metrics, it's a form of vanity. Like, it feels good, don't get me wrong. But that feeling of achieving that particular thing is going to last a few seconds, and then it's going to be like, what's next? But hearing people really resonate with your work and hearing the feedback, and it was like Marie, and you know, I just want to dedicate this episode to Marie, because she was a truly special follower and a special soul, and you know, may her soul rest in peace. But you know, it's touching people like that that truly matters. And I'm on my writing my fourth book now, and I'm of the mindset that if I can make a difference to one person, that's one person better off in the world. So although I've sold, you know, those millions of copies of my books, that's not what's truly important. Although it's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I love the fact that I can just sell books and I don't have to do some of the cringy stuff to, you know, to support myself and right. my family. And I'm, you know, I'm thankful, but I'm going to keep that mindset, you know, just try and work from a place that's authentic to me. And, you know, think of that one person that you might change, because that's where the impact's truly going to be created. And 100%. Any author that's listening, you know, that's how I approach things. And people might turn around to me and say, oh, it's easy for you to say now that you've sold X amount of copies. I'm just a normal guy, you know, I've just gone through a normal process, and I'm grateful for everything I've achieved so far, but you know, that's, I'm going to still work from that same mindset.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, hey, Vex, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, man. It's been awesome. And I'm so glad we finally got to do it and connect and just share your work with everyone that's listening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Corey. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.